Welcome to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. With me is In Context military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
Hello, folks.
Although the United States and Japan were enemies in World War II, Japan today is the United States' most important ally in the Pacific and Asia. Japan's ties to the United States are especially important now as China, a newcomer to the international stage, begins to challenge U.S. power in the East. In today's program, we're going to focus on the history and culture of Japan. In particular, we'll examine the evolution of Japan's important warrior tradition and consider the role that Japan might play in a military conflict between the United States and China for dominance in the Pacific. As a starting point for understanding the Japanese, let's go back to day one. Marshawn, can you talk about Japan's mythical origin and what this myth tells us about how the Japanese view themselves and the outside world?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Japanese creation myth says a lot. When you look at most other religions and almost every other old civilization, they talk about the creation of the whole world. The Japanese creation myth focuses solely on the creation of Japan, the idea that a sword was dipped into the ocean, into, well, brine, and then from it fell four perfect drops, and there formed the islands of Japan. And so it's the idea that the rest of the world doesn't matter. Japan is the floating kingdom, as they often refer to themselves. And the idea that they are all the descendants of the gods, because they believe Japan is one of the few polytheistic countries still in existence. I mean, aside from the Hindus, there are only really two major polytheistic religions left. One is Hinduism, the other is Shintoism, which is what the Japanese are. And so they believe that they were the products of the gods and goddesses who actually physically bred the population of Japan.
In fact, the Amaterasu sent her grandson to rule over Japan, and it was her great-grandson who became the first Japanese emperor.
Well, that's also essential. The Japanese belief is that the emperor is a living god. Now, in China, the idea is, and those who've listened to our show on China before will remember that the Chinese viewed their emperors as the son of heaven. But it was a bit more of a broad sense. As, you know, he's a deity, but, you know, people don't go make offerings to the emperor. You know, it was much more in a Confucian sense, Confucianism being not a very rigid way of thinking in terms of religion, you know, not a rigid concept of God or gods. It's very much more ancestor worship combined with the fact that, well, they're the deities, the emperor is the son of heaven, but, you know, it's a little bit more nebulous as opposed to the Japanese, the very rigid sense of
literally,
the emperor.
The emperor literally descends from the sun goddess.
And the emperor is himself a god. He is divine. They refer to the emperor even to this day as Kami-sama, which means God.
So how would you describe Japanese-ness?
Well, Japanese-ness, it's interesting that you should mention that. What makes somebody Japanese is very unique. I traveled a lot in Japan. I lived in Japan for a while. I speak fluent Japanese. And one of the things that struck me is that no matter how well I spoke the language, no matter how strongly I immersed myself in the culture, I was always going to be on the outside. I was gaijin. I was a foreigner. And moreover, though, people who didn't look Japanese enough, who were completely Japanese but didn't look Japanese enough, were also treated like gaijin. And they used to have TV shows which featured what they called halves, kids who were half-breeds, basically. I mean, it's something reminiscent out of Nazi Germany and the Nuremberg.
The idea of Aryan purity and all that.
Yeah, the Nuremberg laws and whatnot.
The opposite of the American view of country, which is polyglot.
It's opposite of almost every other civilizations. I mean, even the Germans, even with the Nuremberg laws, that was more anti-Semitic than anything else, because even then, if you weren't blonde hair and blue-eyed, but you were brown-haired and brown-eyed, you were still German. Whereas in Japan, if you have curly hair and freckles, for whatever reason, a recessive gene, which people have, you have that recessive gene, you're going to be treated as an outcast. And so the Japanese sense of Japanese-ness is very, very racial. It's incredibly racial. It's beyond just simply linguistics. It's almost purely racial. And, one of the things I used to say, which the Japanese would go nuts for, is I'd say, "Watashi wa Amerika jin desu keredomo watashi no kokoro wa Nihon jin desu," which means I'm an American, but my heart is Japanese. And they used to go nuts for that. They loved the idea. But at the same hand, there was no way you were going to break into the culture. And that was just a fact. The only way to be Japanese was to be born Japanese and to look the right kind of Japanese. Because there were Korean kids in my school who looked Japanese. I mean, because ethnically speaking, they're the same people. But the fact that this person was half Korean, she was treated like an outcast.
Well, now, as we focus on the Japanese military, the warrior tradition, there are two very important aspects that we have to discuss. One is the warrior class, known as the samurai, and the other is the moral code of conduct, known as Bushido. Can you first tell us who were the samurai?
The samurai, the word samurai means to serve, one who serves. And so the samurai were dedicated warriors. Up until the 17th, 16th century, anyone could be a samurai. They were a product of the Japanese, really the birth of Japan, which, as historians have discovered, I listened to a fantastic lecture by Professor Machida at Tokyo University. He came and visited my school and gave us great, phenomenal lecture. But one of the things is that Japan was born out of war. The people who live in Japan today aren't the Japanese. The original Japanese. The original Japanese were completely different. The people who live there today came from Korea, and they invaded Japan. And so it was a country born out of war, born out of an invasion. And so the warrior just played a central role in their entire society. And then Bushido, being the way of the warrior, was really an advent of the early, early samurai period. It's debatable when it first emerged on the scene. Kind of like it's very hard to put down a pin as to exactly where in European history the chivalric medieval code appeared from.
But it is sort of the Japanese analogy to the code of chivalry.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, where did the samurai come from? What kind of skills did they have to possess?
Well, the idea of the samurai was that he was more than just simply a warrior, more than just simply a brute. Again, like the medieval knight, he was supposed to be cultured. He was supposed to know how to play musical instruments. He was supposed to be well-read. Calligraphy was very high prized. However, in reality, many of the samurai were not, during periods of war, like the Genpei Wars and the Sengoku Jidai, the age of the country at war, you didn't have the Onin Wars as well. You didn't have really a high level of education because warfare was more important than education.
What was their connection to clans?
They were the soldiers of the clans. They pledged themselves unto death to whatever lord they served.
So essential parts of being a samurai, which ties into the Bushido code, would be a mastery of the martial arts and qualities like loyalty. And there was even a spiritual aspect to being a samurai, right?
Oh, it was their entire way of life is incredibly spiritual, not just for the samurai, but for every aspect of Japanese society. They're very spiritual people. In fact, the belief that, you know, the soul of the warrior resides in the sword, you know, everything's very ceremonialized, even the tea ceremony, which I had a pleasure to take part in a tea ceremony. The tea ceremony, you know, every aspect of Japanese life is incredibly ritualized.
In fact, they place such a high value on honor. They actually, in certain cases, you have to commit, what is it called, seppuku?
Seppuku or harakiri, or both are common.
These are forms of suicide, which is the only way in some situations to redeem your honor.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was, you basically stab yourself in the lower left quadrant of your abdomen with a short sword known as a wakizashi, and then you cut up. You were supposed to do it three times. Well, during the 12th century, they were starting to realize that guys were having trouble doing it three times. The theory was that you would cut up, sever your aortic artery, make three cuts, you know, make two cuts after the first one, and then you die pretty quickly. The idea was that there's a expression in Japanese, which means for somebody to be a bad person, like we say somebody has a black heart, they would say somebody has a black belly. So the idea was to prove that your insides weren't black. The problem is they found out guys were having trouble doing it because it was obscenely painful. So what they did instead around, I guess it was, one could probably say the 16th century, they started to cut up once, lower left part of the abdomen up to the right part, and then they'd bend over and a second would cut their head off. And this was done for defeated generals, people who'd humiliated themselves, people who'd run away in battle and things like that.
Well, now the samurai actually become, as I understand it, the de facto rulers of Japan as a result of these clan wars sorting themselves out and eclipse the emperor. Could you talk about, in particular, the Genpei War?
Oh, absolutely.
Which took place, just to put it in context, relative to Western history, between 1080 and 1085 AD.
Absolutely. The Genpei Wars, it was something analogous to what occurs in most militaristic societies. I mean, you could compare it to the Prussian unification of Germany. You have groups of strong men ruling their own bits of territory throughout Japan. And at this point in time, the two most powerful clans were the Taira and the Minamoto. Now the two clans nominally were subservient to the emperor. But in reality, the emperor had virtually no army. These guys had the armies. The emperor's power came from his clans, his lords, his daimyo, pledging allegiance to him. Well, eventually somebody realized, hey, you know, we got the armies, we should rule the country, and but use the emperor as a figurehead because he was divine, so they couldn't overthrow him. And so the Taira and the Minamoto went to war, and at the end of the war, the Minamoto ended up winning out, and I believe it was Yoshitsune Minamoto was the one who actually named himself Shogun, which in Japanese means military dictator. And the Shogun's job was to basically keep an eye on the clans and control the military on behalf of the emperor. In reality, he was the de facto ruler. And Shoguns were known to poison emperors once in a while.
So the Shogunate has also been called the Bakufu. I noticed that is very interesting because it means the tenth government. And this is a reference to the soldiers' encampments, which I guess actually became the place where the seat of government in Japan for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The military ruled the country. So your military camps were the center of government. And the shogunates throughout various periods of time, we see were always more important than the emperor after the Genpei Wars. You see, the emperor really just takes sort of a symbolic role.
Yeah. And in fact, this really, well, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but it does continue to the 19th century, the shogunate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that was left by the end of World War II was the lack of a military dictator. And nowadays, it's kind of the country sort of floated aimlessly without, rudderless, one could say, because you have the emperor, who's basically a figurehead, and you have no strongman general.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context's website is incontextreport.com, and you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott-Rowe about Japan, the United States' most important ally in the Pacific. In particular, we're discussing Japan's important warrior tradition and considering the role that Japan might play in a military conflict in the East involving the United States and China. Very important events occurred in the 13th century that involved China. China actually tried to invade Japan twice, in 1247 and 1281. Can you talk about the Chinese attempted invasions of Japan?
Well, this was Kublai Khan, you know, the grandson of Genghis Khan. Kublai Khan decides that, you know, Japan's this, they've taken over Korea, they've taken over all of China. He sees this tiny island off the coast of China, and he says, you know, we're going to take it. For no other reason than we're just going to conquer it. And Japan was a relatively wealthy, relatively speaking, nation. But it was also relatively weak in the eyes of the Mongols. I mean, these were the people who subjugated China, which is the ancestral cultural homeland. That's a cultural homeland for both the Korean peoples and the Japanese peoples. So they decide to invade, and they amass an obscenely large fleet. I mean, 5,000 warships to invade Japan. At first, they land, and the Japanese meet them. Now, they had two different styles of warfare. The Japanese, and this really changed the Japanese way of warfare completely, because before, Japanese warfare was, again, much like that of medieval Europe. You saw out your enemy, you called out your name and your clan, you know, and you fought one-on-one. Well, the Chinese didn't do that. Chinese peasant soldiers were hurling hand grenades and fighting samurai, so the samurai thought it was quite unfair, but it forced the samurai to change their way of fighting. The Chinese made a beachhead and were eventually wiped out by a tsunami that the Japanese called the kamikaze, or actually more properly pronounced kamikaze,
which means what?
Divine wind or God's wind. They then that destroyed the Chinese fleet, and the Japanese learned from their experience. So then they built a high seawall to prevent the Chinese from landing. So the Mongols show up again with the Chinese and, combined army, Chinese and Koreans, and say, "All right, we're going to try it again." And they say, you know, fool me once, shame on you, kind of a thing. You know, well, what are the odds this is going to happen twice? Well, they show up, the seawall's there. So then they try sailing around it. They get hit by another typhoon, another kamikaze. And to the Japanese, that this solidified in their mind their divine right, because they were saved twice in a row by this divine wind. So it solidified in their minds that they were God's chosen people, in the sense.
And did it set a pattern for animosity with China that's lasted till this day?
Oh, absolutely. Because later on down the road, under Toyotomi Hideyoshi, when he was the Taiko, not the Shogun, but the Taiko, which was kind of the second to the Shogun, or the de facto Shogun, I should say, at that time period, he invaded Korea and fought Chinese and Korean troops. So you do see a tit for tat kind of going on with the Japanese and the Chinese.
We, as we move ahead in Japanese history, we go through in the 15th and 16th centuries something called the Warring States period, where apparently the clan warfare was so great that even the power of the shogun and the emperor was incapable of keeping unity in Japan.
Oh, absolutely. That was the Sengoku Jidai, the age of the country at war. And after the Onin Wars, people had realized that the shogunate of the time period was getting weak. And all of these really powerful clans decided, hey, you know, it's our turn to be shogun. So they fought each other viciously for power. And the emperor was kind of, again, the emperor was kind of there. You know, he was a symbolic figure. So the idea was, you know, whoever ultimately controlled Kyoto, which at the time was the imperial capital, not Tokyo, would control. Tokyo didn't really exist. It was a small fishing town called Edo. Whoever controlled the seat of the emperor's power, or controlled the seat of the emperor's, controlled Japan and had to win the approval of the emperor just by being the sole military power.
So who came out on top? How was this warring period resolved?
Well, it was resolved first with a collection of clans. You had Oda Nobunaga, who was a Christian. Actually, he was a Christian convert. This is also when you saw the arrival of a big time of Portuguese and Dutch merchants and missionaries. There were a lot of Christians that came over.
So we're talking like the late 1500s.
Yep, with the Portuguese. Now, the Dutch and the Portuguese had two different approaches. The Dutch said, we'll trade with you. We don't care whether you're Christians or not. The Portuguese came in and said, we want you to become Christians or we won't trade with you. Well, Oda Nobunaga decided, hey, I want guns. Guns are the way of the future. So he became a Christian. Whether it was genuine or not, we'll probably never know. But he became a Christian and he got guns. He defeated the Takeda clan, which were renowned for their cavalry, with a massive armament of guns. I mean, it's considered one of the most shocking battles in Japanese history because all these peasant farmers armed with guns just decimated the Takeda cavalry. And there's actually a great movie that Akira Kurosawa, the famous Japanese director, made about it called Kagemusha, which was about this epic battle. And it set a precedence in Japanese history. However, also you saw another precedence appear, which eventually Oda Nobunaga was killed in a battle with the Iko Iki, who were Buddhist militants who revolted and opposed the conversion to Christianity. So the conversions of Japan to Christianity. So they revolted. They ended up killing Oda Nobunaga. Now, Oda Nobunaga was allied with a man named Tokugawa Ieyasu and Toyotomi Hideyoshi. Toyotomi Hideyoshi was a peasant. He had been raised a peasant. He was nominally illiterate, but he became educated. He started working in the service of Tokugawa Ieyasu and eventually became one of the most powerful men in Japan. After the death of Oda Nobunaga, Tokugawa Ieyasu kind of deferred. Tokugawa Ieyasu was a patient man. He deferred to Toyotomi Hideyoshi, and Hideyoshi set himself up as the Taiko. He couldn't become shogun because he wasn't from from a royal family. He wasn't from a noble family. He was from a peasant family, so he made himself the Taiko, which was kind of like second to the shogun. But he really was the de facto shogun.
And eventually, a new shogunate comes out of this, all of this fighting, the Tokugawa shogunate, which lasts then until really the end of the shogun period in the middle 19th century.
After Toyotomi Hideyoshi dies, Tokugawa Ieyasu fights his successors for control of the shogunate, because Tokugawa Ieyasu could become shogun. So they fight a war. You have the Battle of Kagoshima, which was an epic battle, outnumbered, outgunned. And it said that Tokugawa Ieyasu got his allies to join the fight because his ally was sitting on the fence before the battle. So Tokugawa Ieyasu says, fire the cannons at our friends who are sitting on the hill. And his generals say, that's nuts, then they'll attack us. And Tokugawa says, well, at this point, what have we got to lose? Because if they do nothing, we're going to get slaughtered. And by firing the cannons at them, it forced his ally to pick sides. His ally sided with him. And Tokugawa Ieyasu ended up becoming the shogun.
It was during this period that the samurai caste expanded greatly because of the centuries of warfare. And I was astonished to find out that in the middle 19th century, or actually at the end of the 19th century, there were over a million members of the high samurai. These would be the guys who were allowed to fight on horseback. And another 500,000 carried two swords but couldn't fight on horseback. And this is a country. So you're talking almost 2 million people who were the samurai class warriors out of a country of 25 million. So this is a phenomenally large body of men.
Well, because before Toyotomi Hideyoshi, you could actually move up in society. You could become a samurai. Anyone could. One thing Toyotomi Hideyoshi did when he was Taiko was solidify the structure. He put samurai at the top. You were either born a samurai or you weren't, because he wanted to pull up the ladder behind him. He climbed the ladder. Now he wanted to pull it up behind him. So he made it so that you had to be born a samurai, and that that was it. You were either a samurai or you weren't. Under the samurai were the farmers, because the farmers produced the food for the nation to survive. Under the farmers, you had the artisans. You had your skilled craftsmen. And then at the very bottom, you had your merchants. Moneylenders were abhorred.
So it's really the antithesis of the American way of thinking. We are a totally commercial society. They are at the pinnacle. Soldiers in America are not, that's not the high status occupation.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that's ridiculous is you heard John Kerry famously say that, oh, soldiers are all a bunch of college dropouts. Well, in a society like Japan, or for that example, the Prussian society in Germany, or even the Russians or the Chinese, to be a soldier is one of the pinnacles. You know, it's to be really a elite person in society is to be a soldier, especially to be an officer. Whereas in America, it's kind of viewed as the career for rejects, which is absolutely false. I mean, I've met some of the smartest people who served in the military. Some of the smartest people I know were servicemen.
But we're not a warrior culture. Warriors are not the elite, but clearly they are in Japan.
Exactly.
And also this period of warfare showed, I think, the Japanese ability to assimilate modern Western military technology rapidly.
Yes and no, because what had happened right afterwards is Tokugawa Ieyasu's grandson decided they were becoming too westernized. They were losing their Japanese-ness, but also he saw what was going on in China. The massive influx of Western merchants, opium, and Western priests and, you know, conversions.
Well, let's talk about the foreign relations, the attitude towards foreigners of the Tokugawa shogunate.
Well, that's just it. I mean, under Ieyasu and under the previous shoguns, it was kind of foreigners were treated with a mild neglect, but then under his grandson, the shogun himself felt that the foreigners were taken away from their Japanese-ness. They were destroying the Japanese way of life. He also felt that the foreigners were the reason for Japan's social ills and the conversions to Christianity, because part of being Japanese is Shintoism. The religion and the race are all too interconnected, because Western religions like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam all say that all men are equal. Well, no, Shintoism says they're the superior race. So to lose the religion is to lose part of your Japanese.
And they were pretty fierce in putting down the Christians. They tortured and killed thousands of them, including missionaries. In fact, there was a rebellion that was put down in 1638, which was inspired by Japanese Christians, and they were just slaughtered.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think is interesting is if you look into the 20th century, the country with the lowest conversion rate to any Western religion, including both Christianity and Islam, is Japan. Now, one of the things that's also interesting to note is the fastest growing religion in the world right now is Islam. The one place where it's not growing at all is Japan. And similarly with Christianity, it's very hard to be a Christian in Japan. The difference is, though, at least Christians can kind of pretend they're like everybody else. They can go to the festivals and stuff like that and just sort of smile and nod, whereas for Muslims, they can't. So, you know, and similarly with Jews. So to turn to any Western religion, whether Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, is almost impossible even today for a Japanese person to do, because they become a social pariah.
Now, we talked about the suppression of Christianity. There was also a closing of trade opportunities, right? The shogunate restricted European traders to a couple ports.
Well, to Nagasaki specifically. That was the only place foreigners were allowed to enter, was in Nagasaki. And the only foreigners allowed there were the Dutch. The Portuguese were kept out because the Dutch said, look, we'll sell you guns. We'll sell you whatever you want. We don't care. Just do business. We don't care whether you're Christians or Buddhists or whether you pray to fire, you're Zoroastrians, just we'll do business. Business is business. And that's why they kicked the Portuguese out, because the Portuguese said, we'll only do business with Christians. Because the Portuguese and the Spanish felt that they were going to spread the word of God, and thereby the Spanish Empire, whereas the Dutch said this is just about business.
So the Japanese, by restricting the Western missionaries, by closing their ports, managed to preserve their independence, but they became pretty isolated. And that lasted until the middle 1800s, when an American, Matthew Perry, Commodore Matthew Perry, compelled the Japanese. How did he compel the Japanese to reverse this policy of isolation?
Well, one of the things that I find interesting is when you look at this policy of isolation, I think that's what saved them and allowed them to preserve their culture as opposed to the Chinese. So having this isolationism, keeping all the Westerners out, they really solidified their culture. And what they really did is they cemented their values, they cemented their belief systems. And unlike the Chinese, they were able to live this way quite peacefully up until Admiral Perry shows
1854, he shows up. How does he induce the Japanese to open their ports?
Terror. He scares the heck out of them. He shows up with these black steel ships, and the Japanese have no idea what to do. And it plunges the country into civil war because one half of society says, kick the Westerners out. Let's just keep going. The floating kingdom. Let's just keep floating. That was the Japanese mentality. Let's just keep floating. They were not an imperial power. They didn't want to have an empire. They wanted to just be left alone. And it wasn't just Perry. It was the Royal Navy showed up from Britain, the French, the Germans, the Russians. And they all said, we want a piece of the pie. And the Americans were the most forceful. We bombed several Japanese forts in order to get the message across that you have to open up. And so the Japanese ultimately did. But the one thing the Japanese learned, which the Chinese weren't able to, because the Japanese had kept such a regimented society from the time of the Sengokujidai up until the opening of Japan in the 1850s, they had kept such a regimented society that when the whole society said, we're kicking out the foreigners, everybody did it. And then when the whole society said, we're westernizing, everybody did it. Whereas in China, you didn't have that happen. In China, you had constant foreign intrusion into Chinese society, pulling them in all different directions.
Yeah, the two opium wars at roughly the same period of Commodore Perry.
And that was the other thing, is that because you had the opium wars, the Chinese devolved into chaos. Whereas the Japanese were so regimented, they saw what was going on in China. They realized they didn't want that happening to them, so they immediately westernized. They began buying Western guns. They trained a Western army. And they fought a civil war, but ultimately what won out in the end was the power of Western guns.
So how does this all relate to what's been called the Meiji Restoration?
Well, that was what the Meiji Restoration was when Japan opened up, the shogunate really lost a lot of its legitimacy. And a lot of military leaders in Japan said, look, we got to catch up with the times. The shogun's anachronistic. We have to become Western. So they restored the emperor. And there's a lot of rumors that the emperor's father, who was opposed to westernization, was murdered because he died of smallpox mysteriously, rather conveniently, around this time. Then the Emperor Meiji becomes crowned as the new emperor, and he's a teenager. He's a young boy, you know, he doesn't know anything. So he lets his advisors tell him what to do, and they decide to westernize the country. And that was what the restoration was. It was restoration of the emperor in theory, but it was the emperor being propped up by general.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about Japan, the United States' most important ally in the Pacific. In particular, we're discussing Japan's important warrior tradition and considering the role that Japan might play in a military conflict in the East involving the United States and China. So you had centralization, industrialization, modernization of the military, all done in the name of the emperor, but he's not the real power. He's used, right?
Exactly, by the generals. The same as he'd been used by the shogun, now he was used by Western-style generals.
And what happens to the samurai in the Meiji Restoration?
They're destroyed as a warrior class. Although you could say that it was actually a great equalizer in Japan, because now they destroyed the samurai as a class, but then they remolded the image of the samurai to say now that anyone could be samurai. Now a soldier that enlists, because prior to this, you didn't have enlistments. Peasants were called up on a needs basis and they went and served, but they would never be samurai. Here you served an enlistment like you would in a Western army, and you were now a samurai because you became a professional. We brought with them the idea of professional enlisted soldiers.
So an enlisted soldier completed his training, served in the Japanese army, was essentially part of a new samurai class?
Exactly. And that's what's really interesting, though, is that we actually brought, ironically, equality to Japan, though that wasn't the intention. The westernization brought a great amount of equality because it meant now anyone could join that samurai class because the Japanese didn't have the concept of professional enlisted soldiers. If you can imagine, the samurai was the only professional soldier. And imagine if you had an army made up solely of officers and your enlisted were only called up on a needs basis to be, you know, the linemen. That's the way Japan was. Well, then we brought in the idea of professional enlisted men. And so now it gave a route for the peasants to become professional soldiers.
You mentioned the samurai class, which had been widely open to people during what we call the Middle Ages. It became closed in the early 1600s with the establishment of the new shogunate. So essentially now it was being opened again to a wider class of people.
Exactly.
Now, the modernization of the Japanese military is soon reflected in two wars which are fought around the turn of the century. The first China-Japanese War and then the Russo-Japanese War. Could you talk about, in particular, the Russo-Japanese War and how the West confronted or fared in fighting the new Japanese military?
Well, the West was shocked because we could never imagine that an army from the Far East could really defeat a modern Western army, which was what the Russians were considered was a relatively Western army. And they were decimated at the battles of Port Arthur. They were decimated in land battles against the Japanese who fought all across Manchuria. This is how the Japanese came to rule Manchuria. And they defeated the Russian Navy at the Battle of Tsushima. So what we had here was a complete change in the balance. And this is what led to the famous Potemkin Revolt in the Russian Navy, when all those sailors rose up and killed their officers and said, you know, it was the first attempt at Russian Revolution, was because of their defeat at the hands of the Japanese. The West, the Europeans, took heed of this and went, oh my gosh, the Japanese are becoming a force to contend with. The only people who didn't grasp this concept was the Americans. And it took the Americans until 1941 to get the idea. In fact, and this is something interesting to note, books written about Japanese military prior to World War II said the Japanese could never be good pilots because their slanted eyes would prevent them from seeing aircraft flying around them. And how ludicrous is that? The Europeans figured out the Japanese were a force to contend with. The Americans didn't grasp the concept until Pearl Harbor.
Would you say it was their very militaristic nature of the Japanese that allowed them to build such a modern military so quickly?
Absolutely. And the discipline of their society. They move as one unit. It really is the fact that they have a very militaristic nature and that military service is considered the highest form of service in Japan. The other thing that I thought was really of particular interest was that prior to World War II, the Japanese fought in World War I on the side of the Allies. And I saw interviews with several German POWs. I mean, these interviews were done in the 50s, but these guys had been POWs under the Japanese during World War I. They were German soldiers. And they talked about how well they've been treated. So what we see as modern Japanese racism, the concept of Japanese-ness and the anti-outsider sentiment, it would up and down. It would ebb and flow. You know, you would have a period like the Middle Ages where being a Westerner in Japan wasn't a bad thing. Then you had a period like the Tokugawa era where Westerners were killed. And then post-Meiji Restoration, you had a period where Westerners were welcomed and treated well. Then what you had is you had the emergence of Japanese military nationalism that came out in the 30s. And it was really, I mean, it made the Nazis look benign by comparison.
Who was leading this? Did this come out of the generals? Did it come out of the resurgent samurai class? Where did the militarism come from?
It came out of the generals. It came out of men like General Tojo, who decided they wanted to be the new shogun. Basically, Tojo decided he wanted to be the new shogun. And they had, there actually was a coup, and they tried to kill the prime minister. I think they killed several of the other ministers. It was a period of relative chaos, and at least the Japanese idea of chaos, which is, you know, the military revolted, they shot several of the Japanese ministers, attempted to kill the prime minister, and this really cemented the
general's
power.
Did they get away with
power.
This, or the generals were not disciplined or executed?
No, not at all. It was, they had established that they were in charge.
How does militarism reflect in the society?
Well, it reflects itself by the status with which the military is held. And the Japanese attitude of an aggressive foreign policy. around this time, they invaded Japan. I mean, I'm sorry, invaded Japan, invaded China, the Marco Polo Bridge incident.
Well, let's talk about that early phase in China, because Americans think of the World War with Japan as beginning in December of 1941. But really, the Manchurian occupation goes back 10 years before that. So you can talk about that.
Well, the Manchurian occupation began in 1905. Now, Manchuria is part of China, but I mean, the invasion of China proper began in 1933.
Yes.
With the Marco Polo Bridge incident, and with which was where the Japanese claimed that one of their soldiers had been kidnapped, and they sent out a patrol, and the patrol got fired upon, quote unquote, at the Marco Polo Bridge, and the Japanese said, "We've been attacked," and they invaded.
This is on the border of Japanese occupied Manchuria
and China.
And China, yeah.
And so then the Japanese invaded China, and the U.S. and the other Western powers were kind of like, "Well, that's China's problem. Who cares?" You know, the Europeans were frightened because they saw that they had a lot of military interests in China. Well, the United States, I think, we felt that we didn't like what was going on, but we really were not afraid of the Japanese. I mean, there was a lot of writing of the period, and that's one of the reasons why Pearl Harbor caught the U.S. military so off guard, was that nobody believed the Japanese would be brazen enough to mess with the U.S. As long as it was restricted to an Asian conflict, we really didn't care.
But then we have Japan moving into the global scene by 1940 becoming a signatory to the Tripartite Pact with Germany and Italy, which then pledged them to help each other, come to each other's aid in the event one was attacked.
That's when we began to get a little leery of Japan. Again, though, we were more worried about the Nazis and the Italians than we were about the Japanese. You know, a lot of the writings of the period show that our analysts were more concerned with Germany and Italy than we really were with Japan. Because again, we still saw Japan only as an Asiatic
And it
power.
Could be, I think, that the leadership that was running the United States at the time was basically an Anglo-American leadership that saw the great prize of World War II was to become the inheritor of the British Empire. That meant destroying the German Empire. And I don't think Japan was as high a priority at that point for the American leadership group.
Exactly. But like I say, after Pearl Harbor, I think we were really stunned at how well prepared the Japanese were. And Midway was a close call. Had we lost Midway, we would have lost in the Pacific.
Could the Japanese have maintained hegemony in the Pacific and in China? Was that for
absolutely
a country that size?
The level at which they controlled the country was brutality. I mean, that was the order of the day. And that's one of the things, again, we as Westerners have a hard time grasping. When we study warfare, we tend to look at the West. We look at, you know, the Germans march into Paris, but they don't immediately start mass executions of Parisians, whereas the Japanese invade China, and you have the rape of Nanking, you have massacres, you have genocide, basically. And the same thing happens when the Chinese invade Tibet. You have the same thing happen when the North Koreans invade South Korea. The Asiatic style of warfare is total and absolute, whereas as Europeans, our style of warfare is you take the capital, you declare fair play, and you surrender. You know,
in the past, we've talked about the Opium Wars, how the West invaded China to force the Chinese to accept the importation of opium, which destroyed the country. And this happened in the 19th century and continued into the 20th century until Mao came into power. And of course, this has to affect the way the Chinese look at Western powers. Did the Japanese occupation of China similarly affect the way China will forever look at Japan?
Oh, absolutely. The hostility to which the Chinese hold the Japanese is unbelievable. I mean, one of my favorite examples is right now you're seeing a dispute over the Senkoku Islands, is what the Japanese call them. The Chinese call them the Doyu Islands. And they're in the south of Japan. They're completely unpopulated, but there's a lot of natural gas around them. And the Chinese and the Japanese are at each other's throats. And people in China are holding demonstrations calling for the invasion of Japan. There was an article in Russia Today about Chinese warships locking their weapons onto Japanese Coast Guard ships off the coast of the islands. And this comes right on the heels of Japanese and Chinese planes chasing after each other around the islands. So what you're seeing is there's a resurgence in Japanese nationalism because they're realizing we're not going to protect them from the Chinese. We're too busy in our own colonial wars, And we really are not focused on
Let's
Asia.
Look at the relationship of the U.S. to Japan, because, of course, after Midway, the war turns to get Japan. It's really a matter of time. Japan surrenders in 1945. Japan is occupied by the United States. We keep the emperor, much to their relief. We install sort of a Western-style parliamentary government, and then with certain limitations on their military, a very important limitations on their military.
They're constitutionally pledged to pacifism.
All right, and they're not allowed to get the nuclear bomb, right?
Nope. Although the Japanese, I think you couldn't pass, especially after Fukushima, you couldn't pass getting a nuclear bomb to the country even if they wanted to.
Were they restricted in the size of their military?
Absolutely. They're only allowed to have a tiny defense force, which consists of 400,000 men. That's Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard. The Japanese,
by comparison, what would be the United States' comparable force?
We have about 1.5 million, and the Chinese have about 31 million. The Chinese also, though, have the ability to call up around 350 million.
Are you talking about the Chinese?
The Chinese, yeah.
But to look at the Japanese by comparison to the U.S., their army is about a quarter the size of ours?
Yep, and about maybe, an eighth the size of that of China. And you look at North Korea by comparison. North Korea is an army of 3 or 4 million. You know,
almost 10 times Japan.
Exactly.
How about their Navy and their Air Force?
This tiny. I mean, the thing is, one thing people forget, people always think that, if you have a few really high quality, high tech aircraft, you can do whatever you want. Look, during World War II, the Germans had the best tanks, planes, and equipment and men in the world. They just didn't have enough of them. They couldn't produce enough of the tanks, planes, and equipment. And so, you know, technology is all well and good, but if somebody can produce 1,000 mediocre tanks for every one phenomenal tank you produce, it doesn't matter if your firepower is so much better.
What's the nature of the military treaty between the U.S. and Japan? Is the U.S. obligated to go to war with any country that would attack Japan?
Absolutely. And this is one of the sticky situations that the U.S. is in. You see, the United States finds itself today in a position where Israel's provoking a war in the Middle East because Israel's sick and tired of waiting for the U.S. to do something about Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, and Egypt. So Israel's trying to say, all right, well, because we have a similar treaty with Israel. Israel's saying, all right, well, we're going to start something off. We're going to force the U.S. to make a decision. Well, at the same time, North Korea is saying, okay, here's an opportunity. The U.S. is distracted in the Middle East. Let's provoke something in Asia. And the Chinese are doing the same thing to the Japanese. So while we're constitutionally pledged to defend Japan, by treaty pledged to defend Japan, Korea, and Israel, the Arab powers and the Persians and the Russians and the Asiatic powers, North Korea and China, both all of them know that we don't have the capabilities to fight them. The other thing is there's a cognitive dissonance that's going on in the U.S. that's not in Japan. When I was in Japan, the Japanese were saying sooner or later, we're going to go to war with China and the U.S. better be here to help us.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. In Context website is incontextreport.com. And you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about Japan, the United States' most important ally in the Pacific. In particular, we're discussing Japan's important warrior tradition and considering the role that Japan might play in a military conflict in the East involving the United States and China. You've talked about in the past China's training for the next war, right?
Oh yeah.
And what have they said about their training?
Well, the People's Liberation Army Academy, the commandant of the academy, said we're training for war with the United States.
Do they have to attack Japan if they go to war with the United States? Is that from a strategic point of view?
I mean, our fleet's located in Yokohama and Okinawa, so they'd have to. So, but they want to. That's the thing. They want to. And part of what's brilliant about this is because the U.S. military is so spread out, China can, you know, kind of have its cake and eat it too. They can invade the Pacific. We will be dumbfounded because in many intelligence circles, people I talk to say, China would never go to war with the U.S. They need us too badly. Well, it's brilliant. You break our back and then you force us to buy your cheap products. It could still pan out very well for China. The Chinese philosophy is an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years. In the words of the Chinese political philosopher, it's...
You think that a land invasion of Japan is conceivable by China?
Absolutely. It would be easy for the Chinese because they have a 30 million man army. And the need to, if they have to, 20 million men and women reach military age every year. I mean, a war of attrition would be impossible against the Chinese.
Would the U.S. Air defense umbrella be sufficient to keep Chinese off Japanese shores?
No, not with the size of the Chinese Air Force and its proximity. And the Chinese would be to launch a first strike, knock out our Air Force. And
how many troops do we have in Japan today?
Around 40,000. We have about 25,000 in Korea. We've actually dropped the number of troops because we've been shipping them all to the Middle East.
So we have enough troops to put up a fight and make a show, but not enough to defend the country.
We have enough to sacrifice, not put up a fight. Because if the Chinese show up with 1 million, 2 million, 3 million men in Japan, they'll flatten the country. I mean, our 40,000 won't make a dent. And then similarly in Korea, North Korea is making all this hooting and hollering about war with the South, and we're blowing it off like it's not a big deal. But the fact is that South Korea has an army smaller than that of Japan, or so, approximately.
Yeah, what's the relation? How does North Korea see Japan?
The same way the Chinese do. Because of the legacy of the Japanese occupation of Korea, which was just as brutal as China, the Koreans, including the South Koreans, hate the Japanese with a flaming passion. So the North Koreans would love nothing more than to invade South Korea and invade Japan. And so if they could be part of a Chinese invasion of Japan, more the merrier.
Is it fair to say that they're sort of the junior partners, the Chinese, and they take their direction from China?
Absolutely, absolutely. The relationship between China and North Korea is like Russia and Iran. And a lot of people say, because the Chinese are very smart, what they'll do on the one hand is they'll say, they'll say, we condemn North Korea's missile launch, yet every intelligence report I'm reading says that the missile material for North Korea's recent successful launch came from China. So you'd have to be blind. You'd have to be blind or mad to believe that the Chinese are not helping the North Koreans actively. And North Koreans would all starve to death if it wasn't for China. So China really isn't condemning it. China is doing double speak.
How does the United States, obviously California is thousands of miles from Japan, how does the United States effectively wage a campaign at that distance against a big power like China with the help of Korea?
Part of the problem is that there is such a cognitive dissonance right now in the U.S. and our forces are all concentrated in the Middle East. So it would really fall on the Japanese and their tiny military to hold up the fight, because what would happen is a conflict would break out. North Korea would launch a missile, or North Korean troops would cross the border. Chinese troops would seize the islands or even start a land invasion of Japan. And there would be a cognitive dissonance going on in the U.S. leadership. One of the things we see is President Obama is not a decisive leader. He's a very indecisive leader. More likely than not, if that were to happen, he would probably cease to make a decision. Obama's international policies are analogous to that of Joseph Stalin. Stalin hoped to let the Germans and the other Western powers destroy each other in a war and then step in and pick up the pieces. Well, when Hitler invaded Russia, Stalin panicked and he hid in his office for days and wouldn't come out because he didn't know what to do. President Obama is that kind of person because when you see what's going on in Korea, when you see what's going on in Syria, everything imaginable going wrong. Assad's winning. Iran's influence is now spreading to Egypt. And Obama's reaction is, I don't know what to do now, because he doesn't want to actually put boots on the ground. Well, similarly, if we have a war in Asia with North Korea threatening to launch another nuclear bomb, President Obama's saying, I'm just not going to do anything about it. They're putting on more sanctions. There is no country more sanctioned than North Korea. And the Japanese know this. The Japanese keep telling President Obama, North Korea and China are going to go to war with us. This is a huge threat. And President Obama puts his fingers in his ears and pretends not to hear it.
So what does a war like that look like? I mean, given the distances from the United States, can we get troops to Japan? Would it be a war fought by airplanes, from aircraft carriers, by intercontinental ballistic missiles? What would a war with China on one side and Korea on the China side and Japan and the U.S. on the other side, what would it look like?
Well, it would have to be. I mean, first thing we'd have to do to bring troops over, I think you'd see a return to the use of troop ships, because planes would be so much harder to use because you wouldn't be able to simply fly in and land them in Japan, especially if we don't have air superiority. And I think that's one of the first things you'd have to see would be conscription in America. Because if this kind of war breaks out, we're obligated to go to war. There's no issue of, well, let's sit on the sidelines and watch how this one plays out. If North Korea invades South Korea, China invades Japan, or they just go to war, we're obligated to join them.
But if we were shipping them, wouldn't they be very vulnerable to China's new submarine technology?
Absolutely, stealth submarines. It wouldn't be pretty. they would be incredibly vulnerable, but the airplanes would be even more vulnerable. So it would be kind of a catch-22. You're just trying to pick the lesser of two evils.
So you're talking tremendous American casualties if we got involved in a Pacific War.
Absolutely. I mean, you are talking hundreds of thousands. I mean, this is World War II. World War III, I should say. This is World War III. But the difference is, though, is people always say, well, you know, that would never happen because we would just nuke the hell out of North Korea. No, we bloody wouldn't. And there's a very good reason why we wouldn't bloody well drop the nuclear bomb on North Korea. Because China has nukes. And China would nuke us. Therefore, we're not going to nuke them. They're not going to nuke us. The exact same way that at the end of World War II, and this is analogous to the nuclear weapons thing. At the end of World War II, Germany had tons of chemical weapons. Mustard gas and all the rest of it. I mean, they had mustard gas, chlorine, you name it, the Germans had it. Well, there was talk in German government circles at the end of the war of using these chemical weapons to just, you know what, let's devastate the Americans. One last kind of F you as they're invading, gas their army. They decided not to do it. The reason was because they knew the reprisals against them would be insane. So if we were to nuke, quote unquote, North Korea, the reprisal by the Chinese against us.
Okay, so the
obscene.
Nuclear bomb is really off the table. What about the U.S. Agreeing to amend the Japanese Constitution and encourage Japan to rearm? Is that in the U.S. interest?
That would be in the U.S. interest, but part of the problem is that the Japanese have as much of an interest of provoking a war as the North Koreans do. Because the Japanese, there's a resurgence in nationalism. And the Japanese, much like the Israelis, know that their survival hinges on a war. The Israelis know that if they don't go to war soon, they're going to be squeezed out into the Mediterranean. The Japanese know that if they don't have a war soon with China, the Chinese will eventually squeeze them out into the Pacific. So they both countries need a war in their mind for their survival.
Where do you see this revival of Japanese nationalism in the political system of Japan? And are these leaders calling for rearming Japan?
Absolutely. The new prime minister, Shinzo Abe, said that one of his mandates, now that he's prime minister, is going to be to eliminate the pacifism clause in the Constitution and rebuild the Japanese army. And a lot of this stems from the fact that they see, you see, in America, there's a cognitive dissonance. In places like Israel and Japan, you live every day with the reality of war. One of the things I remember when I lived in Japan was every day, I was on the west coast of Japan too. You looked across the sea and you saw Korea. I mean, not physically saw it, but I mean, you knew Korea was right there. And you knew that an army from North Korea could land there any day now, and you were vulnerable. And so when you live with that fear every single day, the threat of war is very real. The need to have an army is very real. And the need to launch a preemptive strike is very real.
Do the rank and file in Japan want to see a rearmament, or are they afraid it might jeopardize their fragile economy?
No, they know they need a rearmament because at this point, survival. Like I say, for Americans, we have an army. We don't have an army. Big deal. Who's going to invade us? Canada or Mexico? You know. But in the case of Japan, like with Israel, you get invaded. That's it. If the Middle Eastern nations were to invade Israel, Israel would cease to exist as a state. If the Chinese invade Japan, well, first of all, if the Chinese invade Japan or the North Koreans do, it'll be worse than anything the Arabs do to Israel. It'll be much worse. It'll be beyond just simply Japan will cease to exist. They will exterminate the Japanese population.
It's real payback time, like Tibet, perhaps.
Like Tibet, exactly. Tibet is the finest example of Chinese brutality, and the Korean War is the finest example of North Korean brutality. Part of the problem that we have in America is we're so far removed, we tend not to think of these things as happening. For Americans, history ended with the fall of the Soviet Union. We're the superpower. No one will ever challenge us. There will never be another major war.
So you're the Japanese leadership. What steps do you take to build up your military, assuming that the U.S. can't protect you?
You eliminate the clause, the pacifism clause. Then you start manufacturing arms. Now, this might help the Japanese economy because it'll create lots of jobs. You start building up armaments factories, which they've already been doing, but they've been doing it in secret. People forget that the largest battleship next to the Bismarck, the Yamato Musashi, the two largest battleships in the Pacific, were built in secret after the League of Nations outlawed them. So the Japanese have done this before, so they're already in secret building up their military. That's the first thing I'd be doing. The other thing, I think the Japanese have an ace up their sleeve to play. That's why they're provoking something with China. And I think ultimately, in the minds of the Japanese leadership, what they want to do is they know a war is necessary because now it's getting down to the point where it's going to either be China or them. And unless they can drag the U.S. into it, they will not survive. Even if they build up their military, they will not survive a war with China unless the U.S. gets involved. So what they're trying to do is provoke a war before the U.S. gets involved in another conflict somewhere else.
How do you see that the ancient samurai tradition fits into this present and in the future?
Oh, militarism is perfectly fitting with the samurai tradition. I mean, what we're going to see in Japan gradually is a restoration of Japanese nationalism and militarism. I mean, one of the things I remember when I was there was, and this is going back to 2004, you would see buses driving around blaring nationalist music out of loudspeakers, and you'd see guys in black, you know, fatigues giving speeches next to the imperial flag. So this would be perfectly in fit keeping with the Japanese samurai spirit. Indeed, it would fill a gap that was left in Japanese society by the end of World War II. So you would see, I think, more of a restoration of true Japanese-ness.
Well, thank you very much for your insights, Marshad.
It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to In Context's War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context's military affairs commentator, Marshad McDermott-Rowe, about the warrior tradition of Japan, as well as the role that Japan might play in a military conflict in the East involving the United States and China. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. In Context programs are archived for free listening at incontextreport.com and also at WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context. See you next time.